Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Rational Face Podcast, the best podcast on the Blabbernacle. Today, you have another installment of the top 10 books in Mormon history in store for you. Ben, Park, and I discuss Paul Reeves' book, Religion of a Different Color. If you haven't read that one yet, drop what you're doing now and read it. It's really important. I was really impressed with it. It's a great book. So, definitely put that one up on your list. You know, there's not a whole lot else going on in the summertime. It's winding down. Kids are getting ready to go back to school. So, let's just jump right to it. Well, everybody, I am back with Ben Park again to talk about another Mormon history book. Hello, Ben. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Glad to be back.
All right. So today we are talking about a book that was just published just this year, Religion of a Different Color, Race and the Mormon Struggle for Whiteness by Paul Reeve. I just read this, just finished it a week or two ago, and this was a phenomenal view on racism, or just the concept of race, and the 19th century Mormon story, and some of the 20th century Mormon story. I think this provides a lot of the quotes and situations and stories that you hear. It's got all that, but it also has kind of a new context to look at, or a new lens to think about race and how the Mormons experienced that and perpetuated racist thinking. So let's get started, Ben. Tell us about different books or thinking, or how the scholarship in Mormon history around ideas of race got started.
Sure. The scholarship on Mormonism and race really boomed in the 1960s and 1970s. And it's the rise of this field is a great example of how scholarship is often tethered to social movements going on in the world. Because in the 1960s, 1970s, as you had the civil rights movements, you had race becoming more of a foreground matter in American society, you get the concomitant discussion going on in Mormonism about whence cometh this racial restriction we have in the church. And so in the 1960s and 70s, you start getting lots and lots of people writing all about Mormonism and blacks. And there's several key texts that come out of it. There's one book that comes out in 1967 that makes a argument that Joseph Smith was indeed the person who started the priesthood restriction. And of course, this was what most people believed at the time, but it made the argument that Joseph Smith started the racial restriction to where people of African descent, men of African descent, could not hold priesthood office, and women of African consent could not go through the temple. This book argued that Joseph Smith implemented that after Missouri, because there's this issue that Joseph Smith has these quasi-universalist ideas before. We'll get to that later. But then this person argues there's a change. And this argument is blown out of the water by Lester Bush, who publishes probably one of the most important articles in Mormon history, appeared in Dialogue in 1973, that talks about Joseph Smith and the priesthood ban. And it argues that the priesthood ban started post-Joseph Smith, that it was something that developed when Brigham Young was at the helm. And this really was a sea change in thinking of the priesthood restrictions past. And it played a, albeit limited, role in discussions leading up to the 1978 event, when church leaders declared that the restriction is lifted and that all worthy men are eligible for the priesthood. And then that was, of course, followed by a flourishing subfield of Mormonism and race, led by both Lester Bush, as well as Armin Moss, Newell Bringhurst, and a host of others who have done phenomenal work. But then, even after that, we've seen in the last decade even more great work being done on Mormonism and race, most especially moving beyond the focus on just the priesthood restriction and black males. You do a lot more of focusing on, well, when we frame it as an issue over priesthood, that in itself is a gendered construct because we're only focusing on the men and not the women. We're also looking more at class and more especially we're looking at intersectionality between races with blacks, Native Americans, Hispanic, Polynesian, that race as a concept is something that transcends much more than what we generally talk about when we talk about Mormonism and race. The most recent issue of Journal of Mormon History that was guest edited by Max Mueller and Gina Colvin is a phenomenal issue that looks at Mormonism and race from a broad range of approaches. In fact, the special issue is titled Beyond the Priesthood Ban because it looks at race from the perspective of gender, sexuality, textual studies, and it's really great. So there's a lot of great scholars out there working. Max Mueller, who co-edited the issue, is a recent Harvard grad who is doing wonderful work on Mormonism and race in the 19th century. So is Amanda Hendricks Komodo, a wonderful scholar who just finished at Michigan State University with their PhD and will be teaching at Montana State starting this fall. Also this fall, there's going to be a wonderful conference at the University of Utah put together by Paul Reeve, the author of the book we're discussing, and focused on Mormonism and race from a historical, from an urban, from a cultural, from a feminist perspective. And it's probably going to be one of the most important cultural moments in Mormon culture, this conference going on, that anyone in Utah should move heaven and earth to attend. And I think that's October 8th and 9th or so. And it includes a plenary address by Lester Bush, the author of that influential article. And so that all leads to this book that Paul Reeve has been working on for the last decade, really, and was published in January by Oxford University Press.
And one other book from one of our Rational Faiths authors that I think is important is Russell Stevenson put together a documentary history. And for listeners that read the blog as well, Michael Barker, I'm putting more pressure on him. He read it a couple months ago and has been meaning to do a review, and I think he's in the middle of that. So that's another contribution. And Russell tells me, I've only read Reeve's book, I haven't read Russell's yet, but he tells me that he focuses more on the 20th century. And Reeve really focuses on the 19th
right.
century.
Reeve's book is a 19th century book. And so there are some good documentary sources. Russell's book is a useful documentary source. There's another documentary source coming out this fall from Newell Bringhurst and Matt Harris. That's another documentary history of Mormonism and race that's going to be useful. So there's lots of great sources that are available for the casual reader.
So tell us about Paul Reeve. How did writing about race in Mormonism as an active member can be a tricky subject. So how did Paul get into this area of Mormon history?
Well, Paul is a historian of the West primarily, and of Utah particularly. He received his PhD in history from the University of Utah, working under one of the leading lights in new Mormon history, Dean May. And he's been teaching at the University of Utah for about 10 years. He's actually one of the leading scholars of the mid-career Mormon studies generation. He wrote a fabulous first book on interactions between Mormons, Native Americans, and miners in the West. That's really good, and I recommend people who are interested in Utah and Western history to read. And then he became interested in Mormonism and whiteness. Whiteness is a key and novel approach to racial history in academia. So first, racial studies in general, for those who may not be as nerdy as we are in having this background and the historiography, it might come as a surprise to a lot of general readers that ideas like race were not always fixed, that it was all often a fluid concept, something that would change, and that someone that we a type of people who we would just obviously think, oh, they're white or they're black. Well, those concepts really changed over time. And so historians in the last few decades have really demonstrated how race is a social construct that we need to unpack. And whiteness studies is a segment of that movement that shows how ideas of whether a person is white is tethered to a conception of civilization, it's tethered to a conception of citizenship, it's tethered to a conception of social belonging. And so people aren't just white or non-white. People are either argued to be, oh, I am white because, or oh, this person is not white because. And those explanations usually have nothing to do with the pigment of their skin, and much more to do with their culture, their habits, their assumptions, their beliefs. And so what Paul Reeve does with this book is he uses Mormonism as a case study to see how whiteness was developed in the 19th century.
You know, and as someone that is, I guess, either sensitized or just concerned about saying the wrong thing or whatever, as a white male, it was really weird to see the book talking about whiteness and it as whiteness as being the good thing or the top of the social hierarchy, that kind of thing. And so that was a little odd. But what struck me is that even the people that were white by the pigment of their skin, if they were not the right sort of people, if they were lower class, if they were considered either paupers or impoverished or something like that, there was some sort of label that was attached to them that made them not white or therefore not quite right, not quite acceptable. And so it was really interesting to see that play out, because often we hear that in the 19th century, everyone was racist and, you know, they just thought of things differently. But it's not really clear on what that really means, other than people in the past were jerks.
Right. And what really comes out in this book is how it shows that being described as white really meant something. It wasn't just a rhetorical debate, but that your claims to whiteness meant your claims to citizenship. It meant your claims to respect. It meant your claims to be able to participate in the democratic process, because these Americans, they believed that democracy would only work with quote unquote white people. And if you don't fall under the caliber of what they feel whiteness should be, then you're out of luck and you're going to be marginalized.
Yeah, it was a way to be legitimate.
Right, absolutely. And so what this book argues, the central argument, is that in 19th century America, citizenship, whiteness, and civilization were all these fluid yet synonymous terms that were crucial to your everyday experience. That race, as we understand it, was a highly unstable concept, that it lacked the quote-unquote scientific elements that would later come to define race, which, of course, we know today, scientific natures of all these, you know, pure different race lines is a figment of our imagination. But put simply, race was socially constructed in that looking at how non-Mormons treated Mormons and how Mormons presented themselves is an excellent case study to understand how that construction took place. Because Mormons posed a problem to white Americans' worldview, because they appeared to be white, but their actions and beliefs threatened what was believed to be white social order. So Americans then depicted them as what Reeve says, less than white. And by depicting them as less than white, as in cahoots with Native Americans, with blacks, or with the Irish, or whatever different ethnic group was the cup of the day, they would cut them off from the rights of civilization, from citizenship, from respect, and justify a lot of their actions. And then in response to that, the Mormons would try to reclaim their whiteness in many ways, and in part by doing the very same type of marginalization of minorities that they were victims of themselves. And so in response to this external perceptions of Mormons not being white enough. Mormon says, no, we are white, and we're going to do things that prove our whiteness, like colonize native space, marginalize black bodies, and utilize Asian migrant workers. And so the very poignant image that becomes the cover of the book comes from a Time magazine cartoon of the Mormon elder Barry, who looks, you know, very much like Joseph F. Smith, to show Mormon elder Barry, this old bearded Mormon who is walking around with his children, and each of his children is of a different color, which just seems so weird to us today. But that was the common image back then, that Mormons were a conglomerate of different races, that they were not white, and therefore they're different from all other Americans. And so Paul Reeve uses this image as the framing device for the entire book, that we are looking at Elder Barry's children. He took the one where it looks like a downcast European to frame his discussion of the white trash Mormons. He uses the black child to talk about Mormons and African Americans. He uses the Native American child to talk about Mormons and Indians, and he uses the Asian child to talk about Mormons and Asia. And it was a convenient framing device, but something that I think worked quite well. And finally, before we get into the brunt of the book, I think it's important to note that more than just being important content, the framing and the approach of the book is significant when you're looking at the development of Mormon studies, because this book epitomizes this movement in Mormon studies that uses Mormonism as a case study to understand broader issues rather than taking broader context to understand Mormonism itself. And so there's almost two audiences. First, you have the academic audience who don't really care so much about Mormons as much as they do about race. And so they'll read about Mormons as long as it talks about race. And you have the Mormon audience, who I'm sure is most people listening to this podcast, who are mostly just interested in the Mormon story in and of itself. And having to balance those two audiences is a really tough feat.
Yeah, and I thought he did a really good job balancing those two audiences. You get that sense that this isn't written for church members or Mormon history enthusiasts alone, just by the way that he describes things. At least that's how it came across to me.
Right.
As we go into the book, I mentioned earlier that I really liked, might have been before we started recording, but the first chapter really struck me, and I wrote a little review focusing primarily on that chapter on my own personal blog that I'll link to in here. But it was a new way of understanding how people thought, or how they constructed, as you were saying before, how they constructed racial designations. In the first chapter, it shows how the Mormons themselves were considered something different. And I thought I'd share one story, I guess, anecdote, that I thought we could talk about, where white Mormon converts in Europe were noted by a New York Times writer that they were getting on this ship, the Nevada, to come to New York to immigrate to the United States and ultimately come to Utah. This is in 1883. And the group of Mormon converts were called pauper polygamists. And they were described as poor, degraded creatures, most of whom are women, and as poor, ignorant, and in many cases imbecile people. And the Times reported this basically as a way to alert people in the United States that there's these degenerate people and maybe something should be done. But then when they got to New York, because of this report, the Nevada and the people that rode on the Nevada were inspected thoroughly, and the Times reporter found Mormons with ample money to support themselves, and there was nothing in their character or physical condition that might justify any objections to their landing. And so they appeared normal, but the Salt Lake Tribune, which at the time I think would be fairly characterized as a critical newspaper, and they said that the newcomers that came across were just as bad material as any that drifts on our shores. But even when they got here and they found out that they were not paupers, that they were not going to be financial burdens, they went ahead and described them and said, "They are as great a burden to this country morally as any pauper Irishman who have ever reached America." And that's one of the connections that was very clear in this first chapter of race and morality, that if you were not morally right, if you were not the right kind of person, then you were going to degrade away over within your own generation, and definitely you would pass this problematic character trait onto your children, onto the next generation, that if you don't behave right, you're going to turn into something other than an Anglo-Saxon. And there's lots of other illustrations in that first chapter where they would use the pseudosciences of phrenology and physiognomy, which are looking at the shape of the skull and determining your character traits from that. And they looked at the shape of the eye, and there's an example of a woman who killed herself by staying with her husband who was sinking in a shipwrecked ship. Rather than swimming away because she was so committed to him. And the shape of her eye happened to be the same shape as the virtuous turtle dove, low in eroticism. And the shape of Brigham Young's eye was the same shape that they drew on a hog's head, which was very high in eroticism. And this is why he had this polygamist habit. And he was going to pass on this bad character trait to the next generation, and therefore the Mormons and the polygamists are going to be the downfall of the great society of the United States. So it's just this fascinating view that it's kind of like a Lamarckian evolution, which is acquiring some trait during your lifetime and then passing that trait on to your children, like giraffes stretching their neck out during their life and then passing it on. This Lamarckian moral evolution was a way that race was a very useful social construction in at least in building up your own
right
group.
Right. One thing that amazed me, what I love the discussion between different, you know, quote unquote scientists who are talking about the possibility of a Mormon race. As early, I can't remember the specific date of when it's going on, but this is like 1857 or like 1858. So like the Mormons had only been separated out to Utah for like a decade, and they're already questioning, is there a new race that's different?
Yeah.
And that just kind of shows how much in flux these racial ideas were. And it really sets home that things we take for granted were really up in the air during the 19th century.
Darwin's theory of evolution hadn't even been printed at that point. It was in the 1860s, and it wasn't widely accepted. I mean, it still wasn't accepted until mid-20th century, really, at least by the lay
right.
people. And so there wasn't any mechanism to explain why there's all these different looking people around the world. And so a nice, useful one, since we generally see people that are different and have to have this compulsion to explain it away, is this moral one. And so if you're not acting morally right, that's why you look different
right.
than I do.
Right.
I thought that was an interesting framing rather than just painting people of the 19th century as awful racist people, which, you know, they were in some case, but there was some sort of process to how they got to these racist.
Right. It's very easy to demonstrate that they were racist. I mean, that's pretty clear.
Yeah.
The tough work is going in and saying, what does their racism tell us about their culture? And that's
mm-hmm.
what the book dives in. Because then it jumps into specific themes or different ethnicities that Mormonism is blended in with in the American eyes. First, it talks about European converts, and especially the Irish. The Irish are the most common example of how Americans racialized, perceivably white people, that they present them as these are demonic individuals who in their genealogies, they're just not up to caliber of what a white citizen should be. And so there's a chapter on that. Then there's a couple chapters on Native Americans. And this is really fascinating stuff that I hope is not breezed over by readers in their rush to get to the African American chapters, because I think there's lots of great stuff in the Native American chapters. As Reeve mentions, this was the most credible accusation thrown against the Mormons, because Mormons did have interactions with Native Americans. They started with a new scriptural text that predicted that Native Americans would rule the American continent. Their first real official mission was out to talk to Native Americans in the westward lands. When they're kicked out of the of Missouri and Illinois, they move out to Utah, where Americans were assured that they're now going to be colluding with Native Americans to overthrow the American government. And yet at every point, Mormons had this ideal of, you know, working with these Native Americans, and they never really followed through on those ideals. And this is where one of the places where they tried to claim their whiteness, and they did what most whites did in that time, which was colonize Native land, kill Natives who are in their way, and take away the resources that, you know, is not really due to them in very immoral ways, which, you know, is ironically then showed to prove their morality.
I did find it ironic that they work with, they mix and talk with and interact with African Americans more like people do, and so that brings them down a notch. And then the same thing with working with the Native Americans, either in a positive or a negative way. Just the fact that they're not drawing these clear lines in the sand brings them scrutiny and denigration in the 19th century. And that's kind of the opposite problem of the 20th century that we'll talk about later.
And then it moves on to, I'm sure, the chapters that will get the most attention with readers, and that focuses on African Americans, and especially the origins of the racial restrictions to the priesthood and the temple. Things that stand out, I mean, there's the very common thing that if you read any of the scholarship, there's a lot of things you already know, that Joseph Smith had this mixture of some universalist tendencies, but then, you know, there's the pesky Book of Abraham and some Book of Mormon textual things that, you know, really plant the seeds for the later fruit of a racial restriction. But what I hope really strikes readers is the role that interracial sex plays in this story. That according to Reeve, and I think quite persuasively so, what was at the root of the crystallization of the racial policies in the Mormon church was a fear of interracial mixing. That if black men can hold the priesthood, then there's a growing sense that, well, maybe then they can marry white women, which in the 19th century was still very taboo in a lot of quarters. And it comes to a head in 1846 and 1847, when you have two cases of colored men flirting with the line of dating white women and marrying white women. And Brigham Young makes a change and it says they cannot hold the priesthood, and that's going to be in place. And that kind of solidifies a little more in 1852 in a very famous territorial Utah speech. And then what may be surprising to readers is it's not actually official as a policy, the one drop policy, until 1907, another 60 years. So I think this very long, staggered, back and forth, inchoate, incoherent process from having black men holding the priesthood to having a policy that if you have any African blood in you that you can hold the priesthood is probably going to shock readers, and it's probably the most contextualized and careful documentation of that growth that we have yet in Mormon history.
Yeah, on the subject of the origin of the priesthood ban, it's frustrating as you read the book because you see the further it gets from Joseph Smith and even from 1852, and especially after the turn of the 20th century, the origins and the doctrine, quote-unquote doctrine, of the racialized priesthood ban gets more and more mythologized, and it shifts from Joseph Smith saying something to Brigham Young saying something to God saying this is the way it is. And then you can't question it. Once you move it up to deity, you can't question the reasoning or logic behind it, because God is God. And so it made it much harder to break down and deconstruct. And, you know, like you had said, not until Lester Bush and others were really digging in and using the historical method to get to the bottom of this, it was all God.
I really loved how Reeve keeps reinserting Elijah Abel, a black man who was ordained to the priesthood in Joseph Smith's era, and Jane Manning James into the discussion, two black pioneers who move out to Utah, and their very physical presence in Utah causes problems for church leaders, because it's hard to forget the past when remnants of that past are standing on the Salt Lake streets. And it's not a coincidence that it's not until a couple of years after Jane Manning James dies that they crystallize the policy.
Right.
And then after that, there's a quick chapter on Asian Americans, on how the influx of Chinese migrant workers, especially on the railroad, brought another chance for Americans to racialize others. And as always, Mormons are thrown into the mix. And then it finishes with a really fascinating and fast chapter on Mormon whiteness in the 20th century, and Reeves' very witty saying that Mormons go from non-white to too white, that, you know, in 1906 or 07, Americans can paint a cartoon of the Mormon elderberry, who all his children are of different races, go 100 years later and Mitt Romney is running for president, and one of the concerns voiced is Mitt Romney is too white and he's detached from American culture, and that transition that takes place between those two benchmarks is quite revealing, and I think a fascinating, if very brief, discussion on 20th century history.
Yeah, it was really striking when I read that part, how he pointed out the obsession with bodies, Mormon bodies in particular. He had a quote about some poll where BYU students were one of the hottest student bodies out there. And so there's this huge focus on body image. And if you don't like someone like Mitt Romney in this case, then you find some reason in their body, in their ethnicity, to demonstrate why they should be suspect to everyone. And in this case, he's too white. He's too close to the worst version of white power or whatever that is. It made me ponder and think that this idea of racial boundaries is a very human and very deeply ingrained problem that we're still dealing with and probably will be dealing with for generations to come. So overall, I thought the book was great. It provided deep context for the idea of race. It provided a lot of new information that I was unaware of on the Mormon story. It's one that I think everybody should have, you know, next to Rough Stone Rolling and some of the others. But this one, because it's such a important topic in Mormon history, I think this one, if we were to rank this list of 10, it would be towards the top.
Yeah, it's very important. It's not only one of the most well-done books in Mormon history, but it has one of the most important morality lessons as well. Also, you know, I have to throw in my a pitch for the Mormon Studies Review. If people aren't subscribed to that yet, I'm an associate editor for it. It's a journal that has review essays and articles tracing all major books in Mormon studies. We have an absolutely phenomenal review essay coming out from a leading scholar of American racial history on this book that is not, you will not want to miss it. So look forward to that in November.
Excellent. Great. Well, thanks again, Ben. It's been good talking about another great book. Next month when we get together, we will talk about The Politics of American Religious Identity, The Seating of Senator Reed Smoot, Mormon Apostle, written by Kathleen Flake, which covers this crucial period of the Mormon Church coming into the 20th century. It's another very good book, but again, it's a slim read. It's actually more slim than Paul Reeve's book. Very readable, very very persuasive constructions of how Mormon history went down. So I look forward to talking with you next month about Reed Smoot.
Looking forward to it as well.
I hope you enjoyed that discussion that Ben and I had over Paul Reeve's book. For next week, you can look forward to another Spiritual Watering Holes episode. I'll be putting together an interview that I had with Mike Barker and Sarah Collette on their experience with meditation. So, look forward to that next week, and until then, keep keeping it weird.